You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. Welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the sound and beyond. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, I'm very pleased to have as a guest in the studio, Bill Porter. He's a renowned translator, an independent scholar, and he is also known by his Chinese name, Red Pine. He's the author of about 20 books. Some of them are translations of sacred Buddhist texts, such as the Heart Sutra. And they're books about ancient Chinese hermit poets, such as Cold Mountain and Stonehouse. And he has also written wonderfully evocative travel books. Welcome, Bill. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
It is, in our little studio by the sea. Here we are. So let's begin at the beginning, because here you are, a translator of Chinese text. How did you make this great leap, if I may say so, from your educational days? I'm assuming you went to college. And how did you get there? How did this all begin?
Well, the gods clearly willed it. I was getting a BA degree at Santa Barbara in anthropology, and it came time for it to end, and I didn't want it to end, so I thought I would go to graduate school. So I wanted to study anthropology with Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict at Columbia.
I would want to do that too.
And so I applied. And I didn't have enough money. I was getting the GI Bill then. I got $100 a month for that, and so that was not enough, and so I needed to apply for financial aid. And they had all of these things you could check, what do you want, you know, this or that. And they had a language fellowship, and it was for an American who wants to study a rare language at the time. This was 1970, and I had just read a book called The Way of Zen by Alan Watts, and it had some Chinese characters in it, plus it just made wonderful sense. And so I wrote in the word Chinese in the application, and they gave me a four-year fellowship to Columbia to study Chinese. And it was it really stunned me, but also I felt like a fraud because I had no interest in China or Chinese. I just wrote the word, you know, because you had to fill out the form. So before I went to Columbia in the fall, I went to Monterey, the Monterey Institute of Foreign Studies, and my Aunt Pearline came up with enough money to finance my studies there for a summer. So I learned the basics of Chinese at Monterey.
In Monterey.
And then
tough assignment.
And then that fall, I went to Columbia. And because of the fellowship was funded by this program, I had to take intensive Chinese rather than spend all my time in anthropology. I spent very little of it studying anthropology. I took the first course was 5 days a week, 3 hours a day, 9 to 12, and it was with a very famous teacher of Chinese, a woman named Loretta Pan. But nobody called her by that name. She was known as the Dragon Lady.
Mm-hmm.
We started with 24 people in the class, and 3 weeks later, she was down to 4. And then she asked me to stay after. She said, "Mr. Porter, I only teach the best, and you're not good enough for this class. I want you to drop it." And I said, "I can't. My fellowship requires I take this class." She said, "I don't care. As far as I'm concerned, you don't exist." And so I would come to class, and I would be a ghost. She wouldn't ask me any questions. I couldn't say anything. Finally, I had to get the department chairman, Hans Bielenstein, to intervene so I could be part of the class. And she got even by giving me a D for the class, which canceled my fellowship.
Oh, dear.
But at least in some colleges, you have the ability to challenge a class. And so after the D was recorded, I went to the department and I challenged the class. Mm-hmm. So that means they have to organize a special exam.
Lucky it was the 70s where you could start to challenge things.
Anyway, you could. And I challenged it. I got a B+. And so they gave me – but that's what kind of – that was my experience with Chinese. Not only was it really hard, I had this teacher who was just one of the meanest teachers I've ever had. Anyway, that was my first experience with Chinese. Okay. That's how I started. But when I was at Columbia, it was New York City, I met a monk in Chinatown. And I liked him very much, and he taught me how to meditate.
You knew he was a monk because of his robes
in
Chinatown?
Yeah, he wore robes. Mm-hmm. And once on the weekends, he would go up the Hudson, had this little retreat center, and I would go spend weekends sometimes with him meditating. And I really liked this so much. And he was an inspiring individual. He knew no English, and my Chinese was very rudimentary. But I was just inspired by who he was and how he lived.
He had that twinkle in his eye.
And so within somewhere in the course of the second year at Columbia, I decided I didn't want to get a PhD after all. In fact, I wanted nothing to do with anthropology or a degree. And so I quit the PhD program at the end of the second year and went to Taiwan to live in a monastery. Mm-hmm. One of the students who had dropped out of the Dragon Ladies class was a German fellow who had been to Taiwan. And so he gave me the address of a monastery. I wanted to live in a monastery. And because I'd been studying Chinese, Japan didn't make any sense. And because it was Chinese, I couldn't go to China because of the Cultural Revolution. So I went to Taiwan.
Uh-huh.
And they welcomed me at this monastery, and which was really great. It's great to be wanted. But they had never seen a foreigner before.
And looking back on it now, it just seems like a direct path. But of course, then it was just sort of this happenstance and serendipity.
Yeah.
Things happening in your lives and you take this direction and this path. It's so exciting. So there you are in Taiwan and you're in a monastery. But you did not become a monk.
No. No, so, I never wanted to be a monk. I wanted to be a Buddha.
Mm. Right. So what happened next?
Well, I lived in the monastery, the first monastery for a year. It wasn't really, it was like Goldilocks. It was too big for me. Too many people were there. Mm-hmm. And not just monks and nuns, but tourists would come. This was a brand new monastery and it was big. They were spending a lot of money. And so I went to a smaller monastery up in the hills.
Mm-hmm.
There was only a few people.
Was it a Zen monastery?
Yeah, it was a Zen. Okay. The second one was.
The second one was.
The first was a Pure Land monastery.
Oh, I see.
It was all prostrations and chanting, and that was it was very nice, but it wasn't my scene.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I spent 2 years at the second monastery, and the abbot started giving me some materials to look at, and I would Zen texts, sutras and stuff. And there was an English language bookstore in Taiwan that pirated everything they could from English books about everything. And so I could get English translations of these materials. And I started learning the classical language and the language of Buddhist texts and poetry too. And so it became clear toward the end of the second year that the abbot really wanted me to become a monk. In fact, he even talked about setting me up in Los Angeles to be the head of a monastery that he was going to finance.
Oh, dear.
And
there's a path for you.
Exactly. It was exactly the path that was not my path.
Mm-hmm.
And so I left the monastery and moved to this farming village where I lived 14 years. On this mountain outside of Taipei. And that's when I started really translating because I had very little to do. In the monastery, I didn't need any money, but once I was out of the monastery, I needed to teach English, which I did 6 hours a week. But that gave me enough money to pay rent on this farm shed that they had converted into a rental. And I lived there for 14 years, mm-hmm. Got married, had two kids, eventually had to get a real job, which I did at the only English language radio station in Taiwan. It's the former military station that the U.S. had to abandon when we recognized China.
Well, I'm so glad that I'm talking to a radio person. It's going to be very
radio.
Helpful. So we are talking to Bill Porter, Red Pine, and he's telling us about his early years in Taiwan and his spiritual practice. And I'd like to know how these years of meditation and your spiritual practice influenced your work as a translator. And how did you begin to decide that you could translate some of these ancient texts?
Well, I didn't really think I could translate them, but I discovered early on that when you translate something, you really get to know it. You can read a book and think you've read it, but you try to translate that book, it's going to be a very different experience. You have to linger over every word, every phrase, every sentence. And then once you've done, say, a paragraph, you realize there was things in the previous paragraph that you got wrong. And then you go back, and so it's a constant struggle, but you're discovering things on your own. And so it's mm-hmm. much more interesting for me, you learn a lot more by translating than you do in reading. And so I wasn't necessarily translating well, I was learning. That was the main thing.
That was your learning period.
Yeah.
And you started with texts that had been translated before.
Yes.
Did you look at them or not?
Of course.
Oh,
absolutely. My mm-hmm. Chinese wasn't good enough at the mm-hmm. beginning. Mm-hmm. So I would see what some other translator had done. And then toward the end of my stay at the Second Monastery, the abbot gave me a copy of Cold Mountain's poetry, all 300 poems, and he had pirated Burton Watson's English translations of one-third of the poems and stuck that at the end. So that was my real beginning with translation, is I love these poems by Cold Mountain, and I could see how a competent translator who had studied himself at Columbia was rendering them in English.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody had published all 300, and so when I moved to this farming village, I just kept doing that. I kept translating until I translated all of them, and I ran into an American who heard about me and came up to see me at my farmhouse and said, "I hear you've been translating Cold Mountain. Do you need a publisher?" And I said, "Well,
you mean he just came and found you on the farm?"
Yeah,
kind of the way you found some of the people.
Well, because you see, in those days in the 70s, there were very few Westerners who were not engaged in the war in Vietnam.
Oh, true.
And so they all knew each other, and every weekend there'd be a party at somebody's house, so everybody heard about everybody.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so he came up. This was Mike O'Connor. And Mike O'Connor had spent a lot of his life in the Olympic Peninsula.
Right.
You know,
I've interviewed Mike.
And so he introduced me to Sam Hamill at Copper Canyon. And then Sam, you know, published my book, my poems, mm-hmm. the poems of Cold Mountain. And they weren't that good. It was my first effort at translation, and I didn't really know what translation involved. Obviously, I was taking Chinese and I was putting it into English, but that there's an ocean between those two shores.
You have an interesting way of describing the translation dance.
Well, I do now.
I know.
I certainly didn't then.
I know, but now, can you tell us about how you view the process of translation?
Well, about 15 years ago, there was a women's college in Boston called Simmons, held the first ever international conference on Chinese poetry in America, and they asked me to tell them how I translate, and I never thought about it, and that's when I came up with this idea that I still think describes in as few words as possible how I go about it. As I see this person dancing, beautiful dance. And I'm so attracted to this performance that I want to be part of it.
A Chinese dancer.
Yes, a Chinese dancer. And so I go on the stage, too, to dance with this dancer. But I'm deaf. I have no idea what is making her dance the way she's dancing. I don't hear the music she hears. Whatever is inspiring her, I'm all I see is the outward expression of what she's hearing in the form of her dance. So I try to dance with her. I don't put my English feet on top of her Chinese feet because that would sort of kill the dance. I don't dance across the room. I get close enough so I start picking up the energy of her movement and trying to dance with her as a partner. And so that's how I go about translating. And so as a result, you learn that there's no perfect way of translating. Every day I go on the dance floor, it's going to be a different dance.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when you do start writing out your translations, you're always going back and making corrections and corrections and corrections. And you never stop working on a dance until the publisher says, time's up. And even then, it's really hard for me sometimes to look at the books I've published, the translations, because I always know I could have danced that dance better. But, you know, that's the mm-hmm. trouble when you publish.
Mm-hmm.
You're stuck with what you had when the publisher said, it's, you know, you're out of time.
Right, right. Well, besides, you know, working on your Chinese language and translating and learning more as you went, you found a lot of resources and help along the way. You went back into China. You had to learn history.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You had to talk to a lot of people. How did you connect with the resources and how did you eventually get to China to really be in the places where these poets lived?
Well, it was fortunate that I was in Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
Taiwan was the bastion of free China. They saw themselves as representing traditional China. And so all doors were open to a Westerner who was interested in Chinese anything. If I wanted to study calligraphy or Tai Chi, whatever, the best teachers were always available to teach you. And so, and there were bookstores. And so I could access the materials were readily available. Whereas in America, it's really hard to order Chinese resource materials.
Even poems that were written in the 6th century?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, even better.
Right.
It was easier to buy a book like that than to buy books about modern China. But I was interested in ancient China, the especially the Tang Dynasty, but even before that. I felt like a kid in a candy store.
And were there open libraries that you could go to
yes.
To like see primary materials?
Absolutely. The Central Library was one block from my wife's house.
Mm-hmm.
So I could go there anytime I went to town to see her. I could go to the Central Library, which had all the archives. The Central Library's collection was better than the one in Beijing because they took everything worth taking when they left China in 1949.
Oh. Okay.
There was the Palace. Yeah. The Palace Museum collection was also very good, not just the porcelain and things like that, but manuscripts. So mm-hmm. I had the best possible library at my disposal.
Okay, and then you went and you were in the actual places where these poets and the Zen patriarchs that came from India, you know, lived and worked. And so what was that like? How did you find those places?
Well, it was, I had published translations of Cold Mountain's poetry and Stonehouse's poetry. And both of these men were hermits who lived in the mountains, but wrote this wonderful poetry. And I wondered, if people really like that existed, or whether that was just a literary fiction.
Right. That's what we think.
So I applied to the Guggenheim Foundation for a grant while I was working at the radio station. And one day, one of my jobs was to produce a weekly 30-minute interview program with some newsmaker who could speak English in Taiwan. And so one week I was interviewing the son of the richest man in Taiwan, who was the owner of the world's largest plastics company, Formosa Plastics. And this man was Winston Wong. And so at the end of the interview, I asked him if he'd ever seen the movie The Graduate. And he had.
He had.
And he knew exactly what I was fishing for.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, so what would you tell a graduate today? You know, I was expecting plastics on plastics. He said, I would tell them to follow the Tao. And he didn't mean the Dow Jones.
No.
He meant the Tao. And I turned off the radio, the tape recorder, and we had a nice long chat. I said, you know, this might be one of my last interviews because I've applied to the Guggenheim Foundation to go to China to find hermits. And he said, oh, if they don't give you the money, I will. And of course, they didn't. And I called him up and I said, well, they didn't. He says, so.
You kept his contact information.
Of course. Yeah, I was a journalist.
Right.
I had everybody's phone number in Taiwan in those days. So I called him up and he said, well, how much do you need? And I said, you know, maybe about $4,000 or $5,000. And he said, you want that in cash or traveler's checks? So I went down there later that day and picked up some traveler's checks, and I called up my friend Steve Johnson in Port Townsend, and I said, I need a photographer, and you're the guy. And I said, I got to go to China to find hermits. You want to come? And so—
Steve did not hesitate to say yes.
Yeah, as soon as he got his passport and ticket, he met me in Hong Kong, and we went to China to find hermits.
And not very many people were traveling in China, and you weren't exactly just going to the big tourist sites.
Oh, no, yeah.
I mean, you kind of skipped over the Great Wall, and maybe you peeked at the Forbidden City, but, you know, you were going into the mountains, into the rural areas along the rivers and to find hermits.
And so I had no idea.
How did you do that?
Well, I knew they must be in the mountains, but if you look at a map of China, there's mountains all over the place. But I started this trip, and we flew into Beijing, and I went to this one monastery where the Buddhist Association of China was located, and I just happened to meet the deputy director, and we had this short conversation, and I said, you know, I've translated the poetry of Cold Mountain and Stonehouse, and I want to try to meet people like that. Do you know if there's any place in China where there are hermits? And he didn't even blink an eye. He said, you know, I don't think there's too many anymore, but maybe in the Zhongnan Mountains. I didn't even know where the Zhongnan Mountains were. It turns out they're south of Xi'an. So a week later, Steve and I, you know, we're in Xi'an, we grab a taxi and tell them we want to go to the Zhongnan Mountains. And the Zhongnan Mountains, it turns out, aren't a mountain. They are east-west. They go for about 300, 400 kilometers and about 100 kilometers north to south. So we just tell this taxi driver to drop us off at the foot of the mountain and come back in 2 days. And so we hiked into the mountains, and within a couple hours, I'm writing down hermit addresses. I mean, because they're not
You didn't have a GPS or anything then? No, of course not.
No. But you write down these little maps of trails is what it is. Because people will tell you there's somebody over this mountain or that mountain. You go down this trail or that trail. And these are not major trails. These are the trails made by herb collectors, people who come into the mountains maybe once a week or so, and they go off looking for something. And, of course, and hermits.
Because the hermits have to come down every once in a while.
Not necessarily.
No. Oh, okay.
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. They probably do at the beginning of their stay in the mountains while they're getting settled. But once you've been up in the mountains, you learn how to grow your own food. and also gather wild plants. I mean, the hermit tradition is unlike our hermit tradition. Our hermits are made up mostly of misanthropes.
Right.
People who don't like other people.
Right. These are people that are respected and even revered. These become important people. They're not...
I like to tell people just in the simplest way possible to understand the hermit tradition. Mm-hmm. Imagine a graduate school for the spiritually inclined.
Oh, that's perfectly stated. I'm sharing some time with Bill Porter. This is Book Lovers Cafe, and you're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM here in Port Townsend. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and we're going to continue this conversation with Bill, but some of you may be leaving now, and so join us next time to talk more about books and authors, and thank everybody for volunteering and supporting us here at the station. So, thanks a lot, Jacob, for being in the booth as our engineer, and thank you very much, Carl Allen, who is going to edit this, is editing them, and is going to smooth out all the rough edges. Thank you to all the volunteers and supporters who make this radio station possible. KPTZ, Port Townsend.